Imagine a brilliantly skilled surgeon, right?
Yeah.
They successfully transplant a state-of-the-art, visionary new brain into an old, stubborn body.
Okay, setting the scene. The surgery itself is flawless, I assume.
Completely flawless. The connections are made, everything is stitched up perfectly. But within a matter of days, the body's immune system viciously attacks the new tissue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the white blood cells literally swarm the foreign organ trying to destroy it. Why? Because the body doesn't recognize the new brain. I mean, it literally sees the future as an infection.
And if we, translate that biological mechanism over to the corporate world, those white blood cells are basically middle managers with clipboards, quarterly targets, and budget cuts. They
Exactly.
just swarm the foreign body of change. It is the classic corporate immune system response to innovation.
Welcome to this deep dive for Futures Research Unpacked. For you, the listener, whether you are prepping for a high-stakes strategy meeting or trying to push a wild new initiative in your own field, or honestly, if you're just insanely curious about how change actually takes root in rigid systems, this conversation is for you.
It really is.
Today, we are exploring a purely conceptual and theoretical tension. Basically, how do you get a traditional, slow-moving organization to think about the future without the corporate machine just crushing the visionary spark?
Right.
Put simply, how do you institutionalize futures thinking without becoming completely institutionalized yourself?
It's the ultimate corporate tightrope walk. And to anchor this theoretical debate, we are looking at an incredibly insightful piece of literature from 2003 by Andy Hines.
Right, the audit paper.
Exactly. It's a paper that essentially functions as an audit for organizational futurists. It lays out a really rigorous conceptual framework for anyone trying to survive as a change agent.
So, the mission of our deep dive today is to explore Hines's framework as a survival guide. It's basically a reality check for the innovators operating deep inside a company's walls.
Which forces a massive shift in how we think about this work. I mean, the core conceptual contribution of this paper moves the focus away from simply, having all the answers about tomorrow.
Right, it's not just about predicting things.
No, not at all. It's about figuring out how to navigate the corporate ecosystem long enough to get the organization to ask the right questions today. And honestly, it fundamentally changes how we view the implications of being a visionary.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can analyze the survival tactics of a futurist, we really need to establish the reality of what this role actually entails versus what pop culture thinks it is.
Yeah, that distinction is crucial because historically, if you go back to the 1970s and early 80s, the quote-unquote futurists inside large corporations were often just strategic planners.
Just crunching numbers.
Pretty much. They were essentially number crunchers. They lived in spreadsheets running these linear forecasts based on past sales. But corporate downsizing wiped a lot of those specialized, isolated roles out entirely.
Wow, so they just got cut.
Yeah. So the organizational futurist that emerged later, the one Hines, is conceptualizing based on his time at places like Kellogg and Dow Chemical, that's an entirely different species. They are embedded internal change agents.
And if you want to survive as this internal change agent, the very first reality check is how you actually spend your day. I mean, Hines breaks down how an effective organizational futurist allocates their time, and this completely shattered my expectations.
Oh, it shocks everyone the first time they read it.
Right. He argues that roughly 70% of their time is spent on process. That means designing approaches, facilitating workshops, building tools. Only 20% is spent on content, like actually generating those flashy insights about the year 2050. And the final 10% is dedicated to long-term culture and mindset change.
Which is entirely counterintuitive. When people hear the word futurist, they picture a lone genius, right? Sitting in a glass office, gazing into a metaphorical crystal ball, and just emerging with the pristine vision of tomorrow.
Wait, so the resident visionary spends only 20% of their time actually looking at the future. That's like, I don't know, a master chef spending 70% of their time teaching the wait staff how to properly hold a knife and only 20% of the time actually cooking the meal.
I love that analogy. It perfectly highlights the absurdity, but also the necessity of the job. Let me explain why that 70% spent on process is absolutely vital for survival.
Please do, because it sounds crazy at first.
Well, suppose our master chef or our change agent locks themselves in their office. They cook up a brilliant 100-page report about industry disruption, right?
Okay.
And then they slide it across the boardroom table. What happens?
The white blood cells attack.
Precisely. The corporate immune system kicks into overdrive and completely rejects the report.
What? Why, if the report is accurate?
Because the stakeholders didn't participate in the cooking process, humans inherently reject unearned insights handed down from the mountaintop. The I wasn't consulted syndrome is absolutely fatal to innovation.
I see.
Yeah. And Hines argues that futurists rarely have large staffs anyway, so they literally cannot do all the heavy lifting themselves. They must act as process experts. They design the kitchens and the recipes so that the executives and managers can cook the meals themselves.
Okay, so you're building a capability within the company. You're making them feel ownership over the ideas. But what about that remaining 10%? The culture change? That seems like a massive undertaking for such a tiny slice of time.
Well, culture change is the long game. Hines refers to it as a viral strategy.
A viral strategy?
Yeah, think of how a virus operates. It doesn't announce itself all at once. You are slowly, almost surreptitiously, infecting new messengers within the company with forward-thinking concepts.
Oh, wow.
So you might subtly tweak a quarterly review template, right? Just to include a 10-year horizon question. You do it over years, not months, slowly building a critical mass until the host organism, the culture, permanently shifts.
But that means you have to survive long enough for that virus to actually spread. And since futurists have to facilitate rather than dictate, how do they position themselves so the corporate establishment doesn't just reject them on day one?
This brings us to the art of corporate camouflage.
Corporate camouflage, I love that.
It's very real. Hines outlines several distinct roles an organizational futurist can inhabit to manage their positioning. And the most common one is stealth mode. You operate totally under the radar.
Because the word futurist carries so much baggage, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you tell a VP of finance you're a futurist, and they immediately picture you reading tarot cards or predicting flying cars. So what does stealth mode look like practically?
It looks like using incredibly boring, safe corporate titles. You definitely don't put Chief Futurist on your email signature. You call yourself a trends manager or a strategic analyst, or maybe you work in the ambiguous special projects division. You wear the corporate suit, you speak the corporate language, and you essentially sneak the foresight work into standard operating procedures.
That makes total sense. You blend in to survive. But Hines also mentions an opposing role, right? The inside-outside role.
Yes, the agent provocateur.
Okay.
This person is essentially the company's designated radical. They bring fresh, uncomfortable thinking from the outside world into the rigid internal structure. But to do this effectively, Hines notes a very sobering reality.
Which is?
You must be willing to occasionally commit career suicide.
Career suicide. So you're there to shake the tree, fully knowing the heaviest apples are going to fall directly on your own head. You aren't aiming for a 30-year gold watch and a pension.
You can't. If your goal is ultimate job security, you will eventually stop bringing up the uncomfortable truths. You'll become institutionalized yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Then there is a third, extremely rare positioning, which is the public voice.
This one fascinated me because Hines gives the example of Ian Pearson at British Telecom, or BT. The futurist develops a bold vision for the future, but instead of just fighting internal battles, they go out and speak to the global press about it.
Exactly.
And by publicly telling the world what the future of communications will look like, they are implicitly forcing their own company's engineering and product teams to actually build it, just to keep the promise. It's a brilliant trap.
What's fascinating here is how this discussion of roles ties into a massive pitfall for the entire field, and that is the cult of personality.
Right.
Historically, the futures field was built by these charismatic, magnetic pioneers. But relying on a big personality is a huge trap.
Because if the entire innovation department is held together by one incredibly charming, persuasive individual, what happens when they get a better job offer and leave?
The function completely dies with them. The immune system reasserts itself immediately. The organization forgets everything and has to constantly reinvent the wheel every few years.
That's depressing.
It is. And that's why Hines argues that we have to move past this reliance on personal charisma. We have to build a robust, discipline-based process that survives the individual.
Let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this. Essentially, the organizational futurist is an undercover agent. You're a corporate spy.
Basically.
You're using boring business terms as cover, you're infiltrating the ranks, and you're trying to establish a rebel network that will outlast your own inevitable departure.
That is a highly accurate, if slightly cinematic, way to look at it. You are an undercover agent for tomorrow. And, you know, any undercover agent will tell you, You are only as good as your informants and your allies. You really have to map the people around you to survive.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Hines uses this brilliant animal matrix to categorize the corporate stakeholders you encounter. And I want to dive into these because anyone listening to this will immediately recognize these personalities in their own office.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's set a scene. Imagine you're pitching a radical, somewhat risky new initiative in a crowded boardroom. The first person you notice is the guy in the corner, vigorously nodding along to everything you say.
The lemming.
The true believer, yeah. The lemmings love your message. They are hungry for change, they hate the status quo, and they will enthusiastically follow you right off a cliff.
Which sounds fantastic. I mean, as an undercover agent, you want devoted fans, right?
You do, but there is a dangerous illusion here. Hines warns us not to mistake the loud, enthusiastic voices of the lemmings for the actual mainstream organization.
Because they don't have influence.
Exactly. Lemmings are almost always fringe players. They don't have real power. If you only listen to the applause of the lemmings, you'll falsely believe your idea is winning, while the actual power center of the company is preparing to fire you.
So beware the echo chamber of the lemmings. Got it. Then, looking around the boardroom, you have the rats. These are the fence sitters, the pragmatists. Rats go where the cheese is. They aren't going to stick their necks out for your radical idea unless it actually looks like a winner.
I'll admit, depending on the project, I have definitely played the rat.
Haven't we all?
Seriously. If an idea looks like it's going to crash and burn, I'm quietly backing out of the room. So what's the strategy there?
Your core message has to be appealing and safe enough. It has to smell enough like cheese that the rats don't abandon your ship at the first sign of friction. You need their sheer numbers to move any initiative forward.
But then you look across the table and you see the vultures, the laggards. These are the hostile executives.
Yep.
They hate the idea. They feel personally threatened by change. And they will literally circle above you just waiting for a moment of weakness so they can pick the meat off your bones. And Hines's advice for dealing with vultures is honestly shocking.
He says to ignore them entirely. Do not waste your energy trying to convert a vulture. Stay completely clear of them.
Wait, ignore them entirely. I have to push back on this.
Go.
Because in my experience in corporate environments, if you ignore the hostile executives, let's say the VP of operations is a vulture, they just defund your project. They use their leverage to kill your idea in committee. How does Hines justify just ignoring the people with the power to ruin you?
It's a question of resource allocation. As a change agent, your energy is extremely limited. If you spend 80% of your political capital trying to convince someone whose entire worldview is built on rejecting your premise, you will exhaust yourself and still fail.
I mean, that's true, but they can still block you.
Yes. A vulture might try to kill your project, but you don't defeat them by arguing with them directly. You defeat them by finding the final animal in the matrix. The frogs.
Ah, the bridge builders.
Exactly. Think about the biological nature of a frog. It's amphibious. It can live on the dry bureaucratic land of corporate politics, but it can also swim in the deep visionary water of futures work.
That's a great image.
Right. Frogs are usually ambitious, highly respected managers. They understand your radical vision, but they also know how to translate that vision into the safe, boring language that the executives demand.
So instead of fighting the vulture directly, you arm the frog with the data and let the frog fight the battle in the language the vulture actually understands.
Precisely. Hines says you have to, quote unquote, kiss a lot of frogs to find these rare translators. But without them, your ideas will never cross the chasm from theory to practice.
Okay, so you found your frogs.
Yeah.
But as an undercover agent, where are you getting your intel? This ties back perfectly to the time allocation we discussed earlier.
Right, so 70% on process.
Yeah. If you're spending 70% of your time facilitating workshops and managing politics, you don't have time to read every scientific journal. Where do the actual ideas come from?
You have to act as an information broker. Futurists rely heavily on external networks. They partner with outside consultants, university academics, and industry consortiums.
People who actually have the time.
Exactly. People who actually have the dedicated time to do deep environmental scanning. You bring their fresh, unvarnished content in, and then you rely on your internal network of frogs to contextualize and implement it.
So you've snuck into the company, you've sidestepped the vultures, you've kissed the frogs, and you've imported brilliant insights from the outside.
Yeah.
But how do you actually convince the skeptics in the room that you aren't just making wild guesses? You need evidence. You need a process they recognize.
That brings us to demystifying the magic. You really need a tangible toolkit. An organizational futurist needs a simple, one-page menu of project tools, workshop exercises, and methodologies.
Right, because when you show a skeptical client a structured list of tools, it immediately reassures them. It says, look, I'm not pulling this vision of 2035 out of thin air. We have an actual methodology.
Right, it grounds the work.
And Hines mentions a few specific ones, like scenario planning, trend poker, and causal layered analysis. Let's break those down because they sound incredibly academic. What is trend poker?
Trend poker is actually a game Hines developed. Imagine handing a group of rigid executives a deck of cards. But instead of suits and numbers, each card represents a macro trend.
Like what?
Like AI automation or shifting demographics. You force them to play hands and combine these trends, making them physically interact with abstract concepts. It gamifies the future and lowers their defenses.
That's brilliant. It makes the abstract tangible. And what about causal layered analysis? That sounds like something you'd need a PhD to even understand.
It can sound intimidating for sure, but think of it like an iceberg. Let's say the issue is the rise of electric vehicles. The top of the iceberg, the part we see in the news, is the pop layer. Just EV sales are up.
Right.
But just below the water is the systems layer. How does the electrical grid handle the charging load?
Okay, so we're looking at the infrastructure. What's below that?
The worldview layer. This asks deeper societal questions. Why do we value personal cars at all? Is it just a status symbol? And at the very bottom, the base of the iceberg, is the myth or metaphor layer. In America, for example, the car represents the deep myth of the open road and rugged individual freedom. Causal layered analysis is just a tool to force a company to look below the tip of the iceberg and understand the deep myths driving consumer behavior.
That is profound. Mm. But the paper notes a huge tension here regarding these tools, doesn't it? Large organizations are obsessed with standardization. They want the one right tool. They want a master key that will solve every forecasting problem so they can just scale it across the global enterprise.
And that is a huge trap. The futurist knows that the future is far too complex for a master key. When a senior executive asks, "What's the standard tool we use for all our problems?" the true, albeit frustrating, answer a change agent must give is always, "It depends."
Yeah, executives love hearing "it depends."
Oh, they hate it. But you have to customize the approach based on the specific audience.
Which leads directly to the concept of guiding orientation. Customizing your approach means knowing exactly where your audience's head is at. Hines references Richard Slaughter's Layers of Futures work, which range from pop futures at the shallow end down to problem-oriented, critical, and finally, epistemological futures.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is really a lesson in extreme corporate empathy and emotional intelligence. Epistemological futures work means fundamentally questioning the underlying knowledge and social order of a system.
It's heavy stuff.
Very heavy. It's not asking, how do we sell more cars? It's asking, will the concept of personal ownership even exist in 20 years?
And if you walk into a conservative, traditional manufacturing company on day one and immediately start questioning their epistemological worldview, like telling them their entire industry's existence is a temporary illusion, they won't thank you. They will literally have security escort you out of the building.
Exactly. You have to start where the audience is. Sometimes that means you intentionally do what Hines calls pop futures. You give them the highly marketable, media-friendly, flashy slide deck about the top 10 tech trends. You avoid the heavy academic jargon entirely.
He calls this the first date, right? I love this analogy.
Yes, the pop futures presentation is the first date. It's light, it's interesting, and it builds trust. It gains you what he terms permission futuresing.
Permission futuresing. Meaning, they give you permission to keep talking.
Right. You prove that you aren't crazy. Once you deliver on the simple things and build credibility, then you can invite them on a second date. That's when you introduce the causal layered analysis. That's when you tackle the deep, systematic rethinking of the company's trajectory.
Okay, so the tools are out of the bag. The first dates went incredibly well. The frogs are on your side. And the trust is built. What is the ultimate goal? Because it's not just fixing the broken supply chain or solving the problems the company already knows it has, right?
No, and that is the critical distinction covered in the final part of his framework regarding the ultimate purpose of the work. Hines makes a brilliant observation. Organizations are absolutely bursting with problem solvers.
Definitely.
You have hundreds of highly paid, incredibly smart people practically climbing over each other to share their practical wisdom and fix immediate visible issues.
But what organizations lack, what they are starving for, are problem finders.
Yes. Problem finding is an entirely different muscle. It is indirect. It's intangible. It involves looking at the distant horizon and asking the really tough, uncomfortable questions about structural flaws the organization isn't even paying attention to yet. Problem solving is rearranging the deck chairs efficiently. Problem finding is identifying the iceberg in the dark.
Wait, so to do this job perfectly, to be the ultimate undercover agent, you have to actively seek out massive existential problems that no one in leadership wants to talk about, knowing full well it might make them incredibly angry.
That is the ultimate paradox of the role. Hines literally states that people who ask tough questions are often in a race with the executioner.
A race with the executioner. That is terrifying.
It is the reality of poking the bear. Change agents have a limited lifespan inside corporations because the immune system eventually catches up. They push the boundaries until the discomfort is too great.
And then what?
Eventually, many are forced out, or they leave voluntarily to become independent entrepreneurs or consultants where they can finally speak freely.
He actually talks about giving internal clients a no solutions directive, which sounds like torture for a corporate executive. You force a group of type A leaders into a room and you explicitly tell them they aren't allowed to solve anything today. They're only allowed to sit in the discomfort and find problems.
Which is agonizing for people whose entire identity and compensation structure is built on providing immediate answers.
I can imagine the tension in that room.
Oh, it gets heated. As the facilitator, you have to be willing to, in Hines's words, take a beating in a meeting. They will get frustrated. They will lash out. And in those lonely moments, you have to fall back on your core purpose. You have to know when to pick up the phone, call an external colleague in your network who understands the struggle, and just commiserate.
So what does this all mean? Let's synthesize this survival guide. For you listening right now, whether your business card officially says futurist, strategist, or you're just someone trying to push an innovative project forward in a slow-moving space, you are playing these exact roles. You are acting as an undercover agent for the future.
You absolutely are. You are constantly reading the room, deciding when to operate in stealth mode and when to be the provocateur. You are actively scanning the boardroom to figure out which vultures to ignore, and you're tirelessly trying to find and kiss the frogs who can bridge your radical ideas to the mainstream.
You are curating a toolkit. Not just to do the work, but to prove to the corporate immune system that you aren't a threat, to show them you have a process. And above all, you're battling the urge to just give people the answers. You're trying to build a viral infection of forward-thinking culture that will outlast your own tenure at the company.
Because if you rely entirely on your own charisma, your impact vanishes the moment you walk out the door. The ultimate goal of the change agent isn't to be the smartest person in the room. It's to institutionalize the process so the organization can eventually find its own blind spots.
But that leaves us with a really profound, lingering tension to mull over as we wrap up. Hines tells us that to survive, futurists must abandon the cult of personality to become invisible, process-driven facilitators. We have to become stealthy bridge builders using standard toolkits.
Right.
But if that visionary, sometimes abrasive, radically disruptive personality is entirely replaced by institutionalized processes and safe first dates, do we risk losing the bold leaps that created the field in the first place? I mean, can a massive, rigid system ever truly disrupt itself? Or by institutionalizing the future, are we just helping the corporate machine manage its own slow, safe, comfortable evolution?
It is the deepest paradox of the work. By trying to sneak the cure past the corporate immune system, do we water down the medicine so much that it stops being effective?
Are we actually giving the body a visionary new brain, or are we just teaching the old body how to safely daydream? That is a question every innovator, every change agent, and every undercover futurist has to answer for themselves. We hope this deep dive has given you a new conceptual lens to view your own organizational battles and maybe a few new tools to survive them. Keep looking forward, keep asking the uncomfortable questions, and keep kissing those frogs.